Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. This is a special edition covering commodities, especially themes related to what happened in 2020 and what we're looking for in the new year, chiefly with our commodity strategist at Saxo, Ole Hansen. Hey, Ole.
Hi, John.
And what to take us through you really want to focus on in this podcast. I've got a few thoughts on sort of the macro scenario and a little bit on the macro backdrop, but this is largely your show, and I'm here to maybe help some of those that are a little bit less expert in the commodities area to take us through the conversation.
Well, actually, the macro background is obviously the main driver behind everything, John. So that's a great just to get some thoughts on that as we get going here. But it's been a very, well, as usual, volatile year for commodities, but generally one where we are seeing renewed appetite, and there are emerging signs that this will continue into 2020. Some have even, or 2021, some have even said that this could be the revival of the commodity space, which has been in the doldrums for, well, almost the past decade. So obviously, several drivers needs to be in place in order for that to play out. So during the slide deck, we're basically gonna, or the presentation was, and the accompanying slide deck, we'll just take a look at some of the things that we should be aware of, and potentially the reason why we could see the market rally continue into 2021. But clearly, there are two main, or let's say three main macro drivers that needs to be really all kick in order for that to happen. And we need to see the focus on inflation continue, i.e. that we actually start to see inflation start to pick up, with the prospect for potential of a weaker dollar, which we saw here at the end of the year, 2020, really gave the sector an additional boost. And then just generally what's going to happen with in the bond market if we do see inflation. Are we going to see yields move higher? Are we going to see central banks trying to curb yields? These decisions really will have a play a major part on how some of these individual commodities will fare. But I think inflation above all and the dollar are two of the keys. And you've got a couple of slides to just to get us warmed up, John.
Yeah, that's largely along the lines of policy response and the super cycle in interest rates. So I've got on slide two, and so many people have shown this style of chart, at least on the yield side of things. So the blue line is the 30-year U.S. Treasury yield, and I've only actually gone back to the early 90s. You can take that trend all the way back, of course, to the early 80s when interest rates were peaking. But we've been in a falling interest rate. Falling yield regime at the long end of the curve, very steadily so, which means that as we got towards that zero bound, or sort of the ultimate bound of how low interest rates could go, not just at the long end, but of course at the actual policy rate, so the Fed funds rate in the case of the US, we saw for the first time in the great financial crisis that the Fed then has to actually print money to QE in order to provide any additional stimulus into the economy via monetary policy. And of course, with this COVID pandemic, that balance sheet, that Fed money printing has absolutely exploded. And you see that on the red line there. So the magnitude of what we just saw now and how quickly it happened with going from sub 4 trillion to over 7 trillion just in the space of months and really weeks for the biggest part of that back in the unbelievable spring sprint to provide enough backstop for the entire system. The scale of that, and plus the money supply growth. So, again, with yields at these lows, the only stimulus you can provide is via QE, via balance sheet expansion. And what we're seeing is the nature of this is changing over from the Fed doing this to sort of bring, you can bring liquidity, you can bring lending into the economy, but it's actually eventually, you're just covering for the fiscal side. It's this switch to fiscal from monetary that we're talking about. So, and we're seeing in the COVID-19 response that fiscal primacy is happening. Fiscal is taking over. We're seeing stimulus checks, money printing simply to give to people in their pockets to go out and buy stuff rather than to ensure that asset prices remain stable. That's also a part of it, but that latter demand stimulus function. And so, if we're going into a world where there's more and more money being printed just to keep demand at a certain level, there's not more work being done. And if the money supply growth continues, you get inflation. And that's, of course, just the basic, not of course, but that is the basic premise behind how we see a potential for a massive inflationary comeback in the new year. And then, as you hinted at, Ole, and then on slide in the next slide on slide three, you can see where budget deficits have gone. And what we saw back in the after the global financial crisis was that although it was an incredible acceleration down to budget deficits, for example, in the U.S., we're just taking the U.S. as an example, and we see this being largely copied in the rest of the world. That there was austerity, it was tremendous austerity brought on board to get that deficit back towards, balance. And that austerity under the Obama years was something that we will not see repeated, we feel, to anything resembling the same degree. And as you hinted, Ola, the implications of this expanding money supply, money printing, would risk putting the long yields significantly higher, potentially ending that longer term trend. And then the really key question, the big kicker that I think could really set off inflation and even more interest in hard assets, real assets, commodities, is would be if the central banks simply will not allow those long rates to go higher and do what's called yield curve control, yield caps, whatever you want to call it. They sort of hinted at that as a policy. And I think it's a more likely policy if the actual recovery doesn't see the significant enough progress in terms of job creation, and they still see the risk that those higher rates will impact that would be their thinking in actually going forward with the rate capping regime. So that's sort of a setup to the inflationary argument, the idea that austerity is dead, if you will. I mean, look at what just happened in the U.S. They've got a $900 billion stimulus bill, and Trump is threatening not to sign it. He wants $2,000 checks for everybody instead of $600 checks for everybody. So I think that thinking, that sort of competing on the populist side of things to print money for the marginal person, marginal voter out there, the psychology has really, really changed here. I see your next slide, where you're starting off this discussion is simply just to look at where we sort of went from into November, and of course over the pandemic months, the crazy pandemic months in the spring, and since then we've seen quite a powerful shift.
We have indeed, John, and just finishing off the inflation talk, because what we can add to that fear right now is obviously the pressure coming from the potential coming from higher commodity prices. We've already seen that the back end of this year that the weather worries have together with very strong demand has driven key agricultural commodities quite a bit higher. We reached I think 6 or 7 year high in something like soybeans. The oversupply that we overhang of supply we've had now for a number of years is starting to dwindle. And that obviously leaves the market much more exposed if we do have another troubled year in terms of on the weather front. So that's obviously the really bad kind of inflation, the one that's impact everyone, especially those in lower income countries. So that's one. And I think just simply we've had a decade here where the focus has been so much on technology. The what we call the old economy has been left a little bit by the wayside. We've got ESG, which means many investors are not allowed to invest anymore in so-called dirty industries. That's the oil industry, that's mining industry, and that's basically also left raising the question, well, even if we don't have a strong recovery in economic growth and thereby demand, we may actually still have an under market that's being underpinned because there are some potential supply issues in some of these very, very key commodities. And that's anything from not oil next year, potentially that's a little bit later, but something like copper has already been mentioned. Platinum is another one. And again, some of the key crops that we mentioned. So it's a combination of if we add these two together, then obviously that is creating a risk. But as you said, going back to the slide deck, on slide four, as you also mentioned, John, the year, obviously, you have certain datelines during the year which where we had significant events which changed things around. I think if we go back in from a commodities perspective, the first real big dateline was the day that the U.S. crude oil hit -$40. That really woke up the OPEC and other producers. We need to do something, and we need to do it fast. And that obviously laid the foundation for the slow recovery, and then since accelerating recovery seen in the crude oil price. But just let's talk about the slide because towards the end of this year, there's really one date that sticks out, and that's November 9th. That's when we had the Pfizer and BioNTech and what's it called?
BioNTech, yeah, that's right.
BioNTech, their first vaccine announcement. That was obviously followed by others over the following weeks, but that vaccine news really changed things a lot. And you can see up until November 9th, the commodities that really been shining was silver and gold due to the safe haven aspect and due to the collapse in bond yields, and then some of the copper, which was recovering due to very, very strong demand from China, soybeans as well, due to very strong demand and weather worries. And then fast forward since November 9th, the old economy has struck back. We got Brent crude and WTI at the leading from the front, industrial metals still doing very well. And during this time as well, the dollar index or the dollar started to weaken, which was giving some additional tailwind here. So from an early 2021 perspective, it's obviously the latest movements that are most interesting to focus on, but we can see how the world has really gone from virus pessimism to vaccine optimism. And as we talk today, we've got this new strain. The pharmaceutical companies say that they can probably have a defense against it within weeks, but obviously if it is one that's accelerating or spreading much faster than the previous strains that we known about, then the recovery into 2021 potentially could be somewhat slower than what we have expected, so what we've seen so far. But generally, the revival and the recovery in the commodity space is also being reflected by how investors are positioning themselves. And on slide five, this is from the weekly cut report that we publish on our webpage, analysis.sachs. So I also tweet out some of the key charts from the report. Just in short, the CUT report is basically our way or our access to gauge what's going on in the futures markets, not only commodities but also FX and stock and bond indexes, index futures. But the commodities is probably the one that's most pure because most of the trading takes place in these futures contracts. If you look at the FX, obviously the FX futures market is just a small fraction of the overall market, which is a spot OTC market. But nevertheless, it still gives us a good reflection. The open interest, i.e. the big cake, if you have a total position in WTI crude oil futures, that's called the open interest held by the exchange. The exchange can then break this into slices depending on who's holding what. And that basically means on a weekly basis, these different participants, that could be producers, merchants, which I don't follow that much because they tend to be short because they're hedging production. It could be swap dealers, which are banks, which are providing hedges for companies and index tracking funds. And it could be the money managers, speculators, hedge funds. They've got many names, but overall, speculators, what do? Well, they follow the market. They are momentum traders. They like breakouts. They like to buy into strength. They like to sell into weakness. They also, and so this gives us basically an idea about the strength of their position and the strength of their beliefs in the market. And if you look at the slide five here, you can see the belief in further price rises from here is very strong. The combined net long in the three major sectors, agricultural, metals, and energy, is currently at the highest level since early 2017. And what's different this time compared to last time is the fact that the exposure is more evenly split between the three sectors, whereas the two previous peaks we've had has primarily been an energy story, where there's been a very elevated long in crude oil and products, and to a certain extent natural gas as well. But this time around, it looks like it's a broad exposure, meaning that they're still looking for a broad rally into 2021.
Yeah. And you mentioned the dollar in all of this, and I think of course it's on some level very important to have a weak dollar for global reflation to continue. You can't have a tight Fed and expect global prices to come up. It especially tends to impact emerging markets quite strongly. But our assumption with the weak dollar and in part on the inflation story in general is that the U.S. is sort of leading these developments that I'm talking about in those first couple of slides in the macro backdrop. But I think at some point as well, I don't think any country will necessarily want a strong currency and could be mimicking what the US is doing if their currencies are heading too strong too quick. I'm thinking especially here of Japan and the Eurozone. So I think that sort of competitive devaluation game, even if the dollar eventually doesn't just go down in a straight line and finds intermediate peaks here and there and go sideways, that you could still have an inflation driver from other global at a global move in this type of policy direction. So I just want to inject that, and as well we needed to point out as we get through the later in the presentation, it's really important for not just talking up the commodity space, but how on earth do we participate in it? And then the really difficult aspect of looking at commodities for people that aren't familiar with the space, and that is the curve. So the curve of prices, what that means for when you're getting, especially of course, long exposure to the commodity complex. So take us through some of that.
Absolutely, John, and that is such a key component in commodities investment, and also why it's been such a challenge for the past 10 years. Because one thing is, if you are a short-term trader and you follow a market very, very religiously, and you trade it on actively, you're buying and selling. But if you just want a general exposure to the sector, that's where the problems of the past 10 years starts to emerge. And just going in a slightly reverse order, because if you take a look at slide number 8, this is basically giving an idea about the Bloomberg Commodity Index performance. The Bloomberg Commodity Index is one of two major commodity indices. The other one is the S&P GSCI, Goldman Sachs Commodity Index. I'll break them down a little bit later, but just to focus on the Bloomberg Commodity for now. And you can see the Bloomberg chart. You've got a black line, we've got a blue line. The blue line, if you look at, or the black line is look if you look at the spot price. How is the spot price of these? I believe it's 22 major commodities. How have they performed since or the, during the past 5 years? Well, they've actually done very well. They're up 44%. So that's just if you look at the spot price, it's in general up 44%. But if you have been invested in these markets during the same time, you would actually have made only 3.5%. And that's where the role comes in, because what happens is, if you go to slide 7, if you are a passive investor into a commodity fund, that basically means that the commodity fund provider, they are hedging themselves in the futures market. Normally, they would hedge themselves at the front of the curve because that's where you have most of the liquidity, and there are some strict rules as to how they can invest and when they need to roll into the next month and so on. But generally, when you have a market that is oversupplied, which we have seen in general for most commodities now for the past 6, 7 years, then you have a market which is in what we call contango. That basically means that the front price of the curve is the cheapest. And on slide 7, I'll just use Brent crude as an example of the latest development. What happens when you are in a contango and you need to roll a long position? That basically means every time you are rolling, you're selling the one that expires at a lower price than where you're buying the next futures contract. That negative roll obviously needs to be reflected in your return, which then becomes challenged. And this is the big difference compared to a market where you start to see shortness of supply. And that's really what we've seen, this massive shift in the Brent forward curve over the past month. Again, here on slide 7, and you can see we've gone from the dotted line, which was a contango on the 6th of November before the vaccine announcement, to the latest. It's only a couple of days old, but you can see how the curve has shifted completely. And now we're in a backwardation, and that basically means if you are a passive long investor, again, you are buying or you're selling the expiring contract at a higher price than where you're buying the next, and that basically gives you a positive return. And we can basically see that how that's developed over the years. But before I go to that, anything you want to chip in on this one, John?
Yeah, I'm so fascinated by that Brent forward curve at present. I mean, it's not really specifically to the academics of contango versus backwardation, but what is the market actually thinking by having a backwardated curve right now? I just don't get it. If we're supposed to be normalizing post-vaccine, let's say starting later this year, but one would imagine especially into 2022, why on earth can I put in some, buy some December 22 crude right now at dollars, several dollars cheaper than the spot price. Is that an anticipation of lower demand because of EVs? Is that just because out further out the curve, it tends to be the suppliers that are out there sort of hedging their production? What on earth is the market doing with a backwardated curve to that degree at this point? And when, you know, when we're supposed to be looking for this this great economic rebound post-vaccine?
And that's exactly right, John. And that's and the problem is obviously if you just look at the curve, you may not always get the complete picture, because obviously if you just look at that chart, you look at a market which is now starting to tighten, where people are starting to scramble to get the fine barrels to meet the spot demand, and that's obviously not the case by a long stretch, and that's and part of that story is obviously again, speculators. And returning to slide five, where we showed the speculative interest, you can see Brent crude and WTI right now. We have a net long of around 600,000, a bit more than 600,000 lots. That's 600 million barrels. That number has more than doubled since the November when the latest leg of the rally kicked off. Speculators, just like anyone else, what they're looking for, they're looking for liquidity. So they're positioning themselves at the front of the curve. So part of the story we're seeing right now in that particular market is the speculative interest that has been piling into the front, thereby creating a sense of tightness in the market. But as we were going to show on the slide a bit later, we are still several months away from that really starting to play its part. It's obviously the belief in the market that this kind of structure can be maintained. That's also starting to attract some interest, or the belief that we will see this situation continue over the coming months. And I think it's also very important to stress, because if you are an equity investor, if you're looking at a stock market, and you can look across all the troubled water, and you can look towards the other side of the canyon, and where you can see a brighter situation and a brighter future. It doesn't work like that with commodities, because they are produced on a daily basis and they need to be consumed, or they need to be stored. Otherwise, there's too much of it, and the price needs to respond to that situation. And that's exactly why we saw negative prices back in March, because once oil is out of the ground, you need to send it to a refinery, you need to put it into a tank, or you need to store it somewhere, because you can't just leave it on the ground. And that's why the running ahead of fundamentals in commodities tend to be a very non-profitable business sometimes, because market can just build up an expectation which reality on the ground or the fundamentals just simply cannot support. And so I think we'll also take a close look at oil a little bit later, but that's you have to keep that in mind as well when we look at some of these individual commodities, where there tend to be a lot of speculative interest that also helps drives the market. But generally, returning to the, oh, you want to add something to this, John? Or?
No, I think in a way we almost might as well. We could dive into the crude oil, but it seems you want to make another point before we look at the specific factors for crude right now. And you've got some input, and I think it's very interesting, because we've talked a lot about in some of our internal discussions and on our podcast recently, that we have this huge amount of capital or money printing and liquidity injection into the system. And we're sort of rewarding in investment terms in capital allocation, rewarding these virtual companies and companies that have as little a physical presence on this planet as possible. And with that investment neglect, you hinted at it to a degree for the crude oil space, because, for example, take a U.S. shale, where there was a massive investment flow into and capital expenditures into production, and a lot of those companies never made money. A lot of them are going bankrupt. But that somehow, with this focus, we're not realizing that you can print money, you can do liquidity, but you can't print commodities. And the realities of the physical world relative to where our focus is in investments is something, there's a huge disconnect there, in other words.
Absolutely. And just to finish off this section, just take a look at slide number six, because this is just giving an idea about how how the we changed over the over the past year, because basically what we're seeing, and that's basically the to the core of this whole discussion. For the first time since 2014, we actually have a positive role if you look at the average of 25 major commodities. That's the first time since 2016. So since 2004, sorry, 14. Since then, if you had held a passive long position in commodities, and you would basically been out of pocket well, the market, you had some tailwinds or headwinds in the region of 3 to 5% on an annual basis. May not sound a lot, but for some macro-based investors, that's enough to shy away from a sector. Or the reasons for entering has to be quite strong. But just on slide six, just to give you an idea about how this 1 year roll has changed over the past year, and you can see on the far right there that for now it's primarily the tightness starting to emerge in the agricultural space, where we've gone from what we call the mentioned contango now to backwardation. So something like soy meal, you're now getting a annual return just being long today, and on if there's no change in the price and you just roll on a monthly basis, you'll make around 12-13% over the next year. That's obviously starting to attract people back into the sector, and we can see something. I've just put in a grain ETF, and you can see that sector has been really been hammered, and part of that selling is not only because the spot price has been under pressure, but because the negative roll has been eroding the return on your investment.
And just to add to that, I mean, keep in mind on that very chart on the right there, it's gone down to a price of, let's call it, I don't know, 2.5, and it's now well above 3. That percentage move higher is quite considerable in terms of gains
Exactly.
from these very low levels. So very interesting and so key on the roll yield that you've put there, and then on that slide on slide eight as well, that the whole space or the broad sector of commodities or the broad group of commodities have all gone into have gone into backwardation. Let's look at
Let's talk about containers, because
yeah, you have this
that's really
part on containers.
fascinating.
It is very fascinating. What's going on here? I mean, we've talked about this a little bit before in another context, but and this is on top of you know, the actual, I guess, price to get stuff out of the ground. It's to get it from point A to point B.
Absolutely. And we've been discussing this on some of the morning podcasts, but what we have seen this past 6 months is just a phenomenal spike in the cost of transporting containers from China to the rest of the world. I put in Rotterdam in Europe and Los Angeles in the US as two examples. But as you can see on slide nine here, some of the prices just to Europe it's tripled during the past 6 months. And it really is just it's just showing how the world is tied together. Because what have we seen after the pandemic broke out? We have seen handouts, checks being handed out in the US. We've seen stimulus being provided to European consumers. And what have they done? They've gone on a spending spree. And where have they bought their goods? In China. So basically, handouts in the US and Europe has gone towards consumer goods, many of which are produced and comes from China. That has led to a surge in demand for goods from China. That's also part of the China recovery story, which has been very much export led. So containers has been shipped to China to they've been filled, they've gone to around the world. And now basically we end up with a situation where China's not buying the same amount the other way. So we're left with a lot of empty containers stacking up at harbors around the world. And where they're not needed, they're needed back in China in order to send the next shipments out. And that's creating these bottlenecks. So it's not because we suddenly have run out of containers, but we run out it's basically the logistics that has not broken down, but has been challenged because of such a massive one-way move in terms of money going to China and goods going the other direction.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if and when the services economy comes back, if that tightness sort of eases a bit as people maybe spend more of their income, and there's a lot of income that was made. They actually printed more money than and incomes actually went up by record amounts in the US if they spend it more on the services side than on goods side. But everyone sitting at home and ordering things on the internet is, yeah, it's resulted in stimulating the heck out of the Chinese economy somewhat ironically. Let's go. Let's transition next into the last series of slides here. You've got some thoughts on the crude oil situation, but maybe we should have a look at some of the negative risks for crude as well as the positive story. But actually, let's start with the crude story since it's in the order of the slides here. What are the factors? Why is there so much upside here in the near term when there's still this demand supply mismatch that's, certainly in favor of supply at the moment? It's a very well supplied market, to say the least.
It is indeed, John, but it is simply the belief that following a massive and dramatic collapse in crude oil demand in 2020, that that once we all been had a shot in the arm and we start to look ahead, we all want to get on a plane and fly somewhere exotic because we all fed up being locked up in our homes. And we may start to meet up in a workspace instead of sitting at home. So basically, just a belief that that we will see a recovery in fuel demand. And that adding to that the reflation, I inflation story, the weaker dollar, which is also which has become a theme. Because if you are looking at is if you are a macro-based hedge fund and you are worried about inflation, what can you do? You can buy inflation-protected bonds. Or you can move into the futures market, into the commodity market. You can buy a basket, but you can also buy some of the key commodities which you think would benefit the most from rising inflation and where liquidity is immense. And those markets are obviously something like gold and crude oil. And that's why some of that is obviously speculative interest based on not perhaps based on a recovery in demand, but based on I want to hold the crude oil futures because I'm worried about inflation and hopefully that the emerging tightness will give the crude oil market an additional boost. But I put in just four things factors we need to focus on, and I think some of these have partly been met and some have definitely not been met just yet. And that basically also means that our outlook is that I think we will see crude oil, Brent crude, settle in here somewhere between mid 40s and 50, low 50s, until we get a clearer improvement in the underlying fundamentals. But we need to see demand growth return, which has been it's been for the past 6, 7 years, demand grew by 1 million barrels a year, roughly, and that's this year it collapsed by around 9. So we're not going to get back to this kind of growth for a couple of years at least. But at least we need to go in that direction. OPEC needs to maintain tight control. Russia had already said they want to increase further in February. That may be too soon, so that could call for an interesting meeting when the OPEC Plus meets in January. And then we need to see the impact of underinvestment, and that's really also a focus that that the market will start to have, I think, over the coming years. Not in 21, perhaps not in 22 either, because we still have a lot of oil that needs to get back into the market from OPEC. Probably also small increase still in U.S. production. But then the underinvestment that happened or was initiated this year, oil companies is cutting back on their CapEx. That will have an effect eventually and provide some underlying support. And then obviously the weak dollar and the reflation theme. What can go wrong? Well, BP tried recently in their long-term outlook, that's on slide 11, to give an idea about how the recovery story will look in terms of or will impact fuel or oil production. And they basically conclude that we may already have seen the peak, but if we do return to business as usual, we'll probably not see the market or growth in oil production peak for another 10 to 15 years. But really, what it all depends on is how we as a global community will behave in the aftermath of this virus. Are we going to work more from home? I think there are already clear signs from many places that that will be the case. Are we going to travel less? Are business travel going to be much reduced because we can now all just meet via Zoom or one of the other video services? So we just simply don't know, and we need to get on the other side of it just to see what kind of impact it overall has had. But so far, growth in oil demand is coming out of Asia, it's coming out of India, it's coming out of China. And these two countries, obviously, they have been the main reason why oil has actually also managed to recover over the past up until the virus or the vaccine was announced, because they've seen quite a strong recovery in fuel demand.
And there could be some substitution on the oil front, one supposes, from electric vehicles and maybe efficiency improvements. as well. And then maybe that's what takes us into the next slide with copper. Obviously, if there's a, my understanding is there's something like 3 to 1 how much copper you need for an electric vehicle relative to a normal gas burning or petrol burning car. Is that the key driver here for copper, or is there also a supply side element?
It is absolutely, John, and it is the kind of strange thing that you have to go dirty in order to go clean. You need some of these key commodities in order to fulfill your green transformation dream. And copper is obviously a major contributor, because just imagine all the additional electrical cables that need to be put in the ground in order to have all these recharging centers all over the place. So that is the demand story is likely to remain strong. At the same time, there are some potential worries about the supply side, because obviously a lot of this is copper is produced in South America, and there are some emerging signs that we may struggle a bit to meet demand. And so there are forecasts for a deficit over the coming years, and that will continue to underpin copper. And then I think that we'll just might as well just stay on the metals. Take a look at gold. A very strong rally up until the middle of the year, broke above 2,000. We now spent we corrected 15% roughly. We've been in a downtrend since. I think the big key there is really dollar and the inflation outlook. And as you mentioned, John, in the beginning, and you can see that in the down in the chart on the bottom right, that's the 2-year, 10-year notes. The yield, the nominal yield that we normally see in the papers and see on the screens, has been very, very trading sideways here between 50 and 100 basis points since March. What happens if we get yield control and inflation starts to move higher? That basically means that the nominal yield will go nowhere, but the red line, which is break even, i.e., the reflection of the expected inflation, will go up. And that means the real yields can only go down. And if you look on the top right chart, that's a correlation between gold and real yield. And the lower the real yield goes, the higher gold goes. So that is really, I think, if you ask me about one single chart I want to keep an eye on, that's this one, because that has been such a key warning sign for gold in the past.
Yeah,
So
that's the ultimate moment for precious metals, one would think, is the day that we actually start to see those inflation levels ticking up, let's call it in practical terms, well above 2%, maybe hitting 3% or more year on year. And you see the long rates coming up a bit. And then the Fed says, sorry, we still have unemployment levels too high. We're going to cap these yields. And that, I think, is that's the day when you start to see a rapid, I would think you start to see big rapid gains for gold, silver, etc.
Absolutely. And I think let's just finish off with as where you started, John, how to invest in this sector. There are obviously many different ETFs, and there are regional restrictions that may apply to wherever you are located as a listener. But just be aware of the when you look at some of these in funds, be aware of the composition, because that really is quite important. If you take a look at the on slide 14, I just put in a couple of these are three of the major ETFs that tracks commodities. The GSCI, which I mentioned, is the yellow one, and as you can see, it's got a very big exposure in energy. So basically, if you buy the GSCI, you're primarily buying exposure to the energy market. So if you believe the energy sector is where all the fun and games are going to be found in 2021, that's the ETF for you. If you are more concerned about the broader exposure through, i.e., you're looking for an inflation hedge, I would say that the Bloomberg Commodity Index is better, because it's got one third exposure in energy, metals, and agriculture. And as I showed on the previous slide, the agricultural sector is starting to move into quite a firm backwardation, i.e., a positive roll yield. So you may be better off with that one if you're looking for an inflation hedge. And then overall, probably the biggest one, which is actually a Deutsche Bank Optimal Yield Commodity Index. You can see the exposure there is more skewed towards the metal space, which again would be, if you think it's the industrial metals and gold that will be the driver, then that's the one you should focus on. But as I said, these are not recommendations, but just suggestions, just ideas about how the different funds they operate.
And then there's also ways, of course, to get exposure via equities. And I know you and Peter, our equity strategist, have looked at a number of different companies and their links and investments in different industries. Of course, energy being the probably the easiest one to find different ways to get exposure to the underlying price, whether it's services or otherwise.
Exactly.
All right, Ola, it's been a great conversation. I think we'll wrap it up here. Lots to think about. I think some great slides you've put together for this, and some themes to really chew on in the year ahead as we really watch for the continuation of a weaker dollar and then the anticipated policy response. Of course, if we get an economy that's bogging down and not going anywhere, this whole commodity space thing could take quite some time to play out if the vaccine is too slow, or if the policy is frustrated by, for example, political gridlock and otherwise. We want to express, of course, there's always a risk that the general backdrop could prove somewhat different from what we anticipate. But we've laid out a case, I think, for a pretty interesting 2021, and our anticipation that inflation, more likely than not, is set to return, and part of that inflation will be from driven by the physical world and the commodity space. So, thanks a lot for joining, everyone. Thanks to you, Ola, for putting together these great set of slides. And we'll, of course, be back next week with our usual daily market call podcast. So, stay tuned for those. And for now, have a great holidays out there. And thanks for joining.